A man and a hand that would not die play a powerful vendetta. On Corsica, in this story from Guy de Maupassant, the great French master of the short story. Our story is from Murder International, and watch out for that hand.
Murder International, a series of half-hour murder plays that can be heard each Wednesday evening at this time. Each play is written by a different author, and the series will focus on all aspects of murder as seen through the eyes of internationally famous writers of the past and present. In every play, there'll be a different star actor. Tonight's is Dennis Quilley. Murder is murder anywhere in the world. The taking of life, the most terrible crime a human being can commit, is the same in any language, whether it springs from vengeance, greed, hate, love, or whatever. The exploration of these emotions in dramatic terms is what Murder International is all about. And the plays are set in many different parts of the world. The theme of tonight's seems to ask a question. Is this murder by the supernatural?
Murder International. This week's story is by French author Guy de Maupassant. The setting, the island of Corsica. We present Dennis Quilley in The Hand, dramatized for radio by Michael Robson. The Hand.
I still have no satisfactory explanation to offer. The affair remains as mysterious, as hideous, as macabre as it did 5 years ago when I was stationed in Corsica in 1880. But of this I am persuaded. Had I possessed sufficient strength of purpose, I might have ensured that the disaster was averted altogether.
Monsieur? Enjoying the view?
Magnificent, isn't it?
It has its charm, certainly. I don't believe we've met, sir.
John Rowell. Bermutier, monsieur.
Enchanted. Aren't you the investigating magistrate for Ajaccio?
That's right.
Judging by the newspaper, you're kept pretty busy.
Busier than I could wish.
But on a Sunday, at least, you're entitled to relax.
It's a welcome change to be out of the office, yes.
Look, my villa's not far away. If you can spare the time, I'd be delighted if you'd join me for a drink.
What a charming courtyard, Sir John.
I like it. All the advantages of being in the open air, but the vine veranda keeps the sun from frying you. Olivier.
Sir.
What about a drink for our guest?
Certainly, sir. Wine? Beer?
Oh, beer would be delicious, thank you.
Sir.
I must confess to something, monsieur.
You, contrived for me to invite you here.
Something rather like that, yes.
You were curious about the foreign recluse?
Intensely.
I'm flattered. But believe me, I shouldn't have brought you up to the house if I hadn't felt the need for some civilized conversation. Isolation's all very fine, provided you can break it up with a little gregariousness now and again.
You're accustomed to being on your own a good deal.
I'm accustomed to living away from my own kind.
I believe you've traveled widely.
Yes, I've been fortunate to have been able to visit most of the places I was curious about. Africa, India, Burma, South America.
What brought you to Corsica?
That's a longish story, Bermutier. And I shall let it unfold of its own accord. But presently, when we've finished our drinks, I'll show you round the house and satisfy your curiosity at the same time. And I suppose you'd call this the study.
You have a remarkable collection of guns, Sir John.
Hunting has been an obsession of mine since I was a boy. A quarter of a century of slaughter.
Extraordinary.
And useless. I've given it up now.
But I understood you'd bought rifles and pistols locally.
Oh, yes, I like to keep in practice, and new weapons still intrigue me. But I don't hunt wild creatures any longer. Targets content me now.
You've had enough of danger and excitement?
Not entirely. The only difference is that where once I pursued danger, now it follows me. You see that silk screen over there?
What, the black silk embroidered with flowers?
It came from Japan. Striking, isn't it?
Beautiful. But somber.
Yes. Just move the screen to your left, monsieur, and you'll appreciate how correct your choice of the word somber was.
Good God.
The most dangerous game of all.
But surely this is a human hand.
Indeed it is.
But Sir John, this is macabre. A human hand chained to the wall.
Why does one chain a wild beast, sir?
I suppose to prevent it from attacking you.
Exactly. And that hand is chained for the same reason.
If this is a joke, I can only presume it is. Well, I find it far too gruesome for my liking. It's obscene.
It's implacable.
I must confess to being utterly bewildered.
And shocked.
Disgusted.
And very properly. Your sentiments do you credit, and I say that with complete sincerity.
Then why? In heaven's name, why keep that awful thing in your study?
Sit down, monsieur, please, and I'll try to explain. One of the first principles of hunting most big game is to provide a bait for the animal you're after.
Yes, yes, I can understand that. But
that hand is a bait.
For what?
For the man who owns it.
I find this conversation extremely distasteful.
Someday, or some night, he'll come for it. And when he does, he'll find me ready and waiting for him. But this time, I'll make sure of him myself.
I thought at first that Sir John must be insane. But during a subsequent visit to his home, I managed to persuade him to reveal the reason for the presence of that revolting and terrifying object in his home. I recall him in every detail. A great big fellow. Attractive, cheerful face, delightful manners. Really the most charming of hosts, recounting that story of hate and terror.
I'm not sure how familiar you are with recent events on the slave coast of West Africa, Bamutier.
I recall very vividly reading accounts of your General Wolseley's campaign against the Ashanti a few years ago.
You do? Well, that's helpful, because I was on that expedition. And after its successful conclusion, I stayed on in the hinterland.
Must be an appalling place.
It's not a place I ever want to set eyes on again. For a time, I was virtually on my own out there. Then, eventually, I received word I was to be joined by a young officer called Ordus. I knew him slightly. Charming chap, extremely conscientious. So that when he was several days overdue, I began to fear something must have happened to him.
Sir John! Sir John!
Here! I'm on the veranda.
I'm very sorry I've been so long. There's been trouble at Fermanagh.
What kind of trouble?
Some scoundrel, a European apparently, has been trying to buy slaves. When the chieftain refused, the man shot him and beheaded him.
Good God.
Then he tried to burn down the entire village. The locals report he made for the hills. I was terrified he might have got here before I did.
Now, you look played out, Order. Sit down and tell me about it. There's some lime juice over there.
I can't tell you much more, except that the fellow's a Frenchman. The Ashanti and the Denkera regard him with some kind of superstitious awe. They say he's a giant.
But why should he come here?
Our people at Cape Coast want him arrested and handed over to the French authorities in Dahomey. The Akim warriors want him because of his activities in their stamping grounds, so he probably thinks he's safer in the hills. It's possible he'll come here hoping to buy weapons and ammunition.
And if he can't buy them, he'll take them.
He's a multiple murderer. Why should one or two more killings worry him?
It was clear the Frenchman was being followed at a distance by warriors of the Akim tribe. We heard their drums thudding out the message. The giant was on his way towards our encampment. That night, Ordus and I hit on a plan. He would conceal himself on the edge of the jungle with an uninterrupted view of the ramshackle bungalow we called our headquarters. I would remain inside the bungalow in darkness and wait for our man. Askaris would guard the rear. He came shortly after dawn.
Hello! Hello there!
First time in my life, I was truly afraid. There was this huge man, massive shoulders and powerful forearms, long talon-like fingers, lank black hair, black, intense eyes, and that low, harsh breathing.
Anyone about?
Behind you.
What?
Drop the rifle.
Go on, drop it.
Hands on your head. Now. The following day, Ordus, with six Askaris, set off for Cape Coast with the Frenchman, Chavan. He was to be tried, convicted, and executed on French territory. I should have gone with them, of course, but I was still gathering my strength after a bad attack of malaria. A week later, a single Askari returned, terrified and exhausted. He said that one night while they were camping, Chavan had snapped the necks of the two Askaris on watch, shot Ordus with his own carbine, and made off into Denkyera territory. I followed him, tormented by remorse at the death of poor Ordus, and determined to execute my own justice on Chavan. One of the Askaris had hurled an assy guy at the Frenchman and wounded him in the leg. Otherwise, I should never have overtaken him. For 2 hours, we played a desperate game on the edge of that dripping forest. And finally, I shattered his left leg, his one good leg. The Akim warriors raced towards him in the dim clearing. Then they brought Chavan to me. Grinning, they were every man jack of them, with delight and pride. They had cut off Chavan's right hand and were presenting it to me as a trophy.
You fool, Earl. You'd have done better to kill me cleanly, through the heart.
This mutilation was none of my ordering.
It's done. My hand is off, and you shall pay for it. Go where you will. That hand will torment you. Hide where you may. Someday I shall come to reclaim it.
What a hideous story. But what on earth possessed you to keep the hand?
Face, a matter of pride. Chavan had issued a challenge that I had to accept.
But surely he must have died almost at once. Shock, loss of blood.
The Akim took him. They deserved no less. And flung him into Ruwu Swamp, just about sunrise. On the way down to Cape Coast with Harry Ordus' body,
one of the Askaris was strangled during the night. Chavan's amputated hand was at his throat.
What?
Thereafter, I chained it, as you see it now.
But why here? Why Corsica?
I learned in Dahomey that Chavan was a native of Corsica. I knew about the power of the vendetta in Corsica, and I came here to face it. I tell you, Bermutier, that hand still lives. It has smashed priceless ornaments. It has strangled two of my dogs, and it's waiting to destroy me. But I shall meet Chavan on his home ground, and God willing, destroy him first.
You're saying that a dead hand can have life of its own? That it's capable of moving and functioning? Of killing?
What other explanation can there be?
Have you ever seen it actually move of its own volition?
I have seen only the results of its movements.
How long has this man of yours, Olivier, been with you?
You're not suggesting that he could have anything to do with all this?
I'm suggesting, my dear Sir John, that there must be, there has to be some human explanation for these atrocious acts. I judge you to be as honest and as sane as anyone I've ever met, and for that very reason, I'm convinced that some living person is attempting to manipulate you into madness or death. Olivier.
Monsieur.
Sit down, Olivier. I want to talk to you. You'll forgive me for asking you the questions I must ask when I tell you that they're occasioned only by my concern for your master's safety.
Well, I, too, am concerned for Sir John, monsieur.
Then we have a common aim. How long have you served your master?
Almost 5 years.
What were you doing before that?
I was with another English gentleman, Monsieur Charles Vaughan. He was a member of the British Parliament and a friend of Sir John's.
Why did you leave Mr. Vaughan's service?
He died of pneumonia, monsieur. At that time, Sir John had just returned from Africa and was helping to put Monsieur Vaughan's affairs in order after his death. He asked me if I would like to enter his service. I had no other employment to go to, so I accepted the offer.
And how'd you get on, the two of you? You can be frank.
Oh, I admire and respect Sir John. He's a thoughtful and generous master. I know how generous he is.
What do you mean?
When we first came to Corsica, Sir John drew up his will. He read it out and asked me to be one of the witnesses. In the event of his death, he has left me a useful competence for the rest of my life.
Are you prepared to tell me who receives the bulk of his fortune? This could be very important, Olivier.
His younger brother, who already enjoys a considerable fortune in his own right. Monsieur Bermutier, there can be no possible connection between that gentleman and the mysterious events here in Corsica. Monsieur Peter Rohl lives permanently in Edinburgh and has never once visited this island.
You may be sure I took the trouble to verify Olivier's story. All he had told me was true. Sir John himself corroborated his servant's statements. And I was satisfied that Olivier could have had no hand in the depredations that Sir John had described. Olivier was a loyal and honorable man. And over the next few months, during which Sir John had not left the grounds of his villa, I had every reason to be thankful for his obvious concern for his master's well-being.
Bermutier, my dear chap. Come and sit down, do. What a delightful surprise.
Sir John, I hope you'll forgive an unsolicited call.
Nonsense! It's good to see you again.
Oh, you've lost weight since I was last here. You're looking rather fine-drawn. Keeping fit, are you?
Oh, out and about most of every day. Don't know when I've had more exercise.
But the nights, are you getting enough sleep?
Well, as to that, I must say I have had difficulty getting off to sleep for a week or two. But Olivia's decided to start giving me a brandy toddy before I turn in. That should do the trick.
You're having nightmares?
Not nightmares, no. No, but I find I'm becoming increasingly tense. Keyed up for something that never happens.
Now look, Sir John. If you were to lead a normal life, you'd have what,
30 or more good years ahead of you? Why jeopardize that by living here in isolation with that thing in your study? If you must live in Corsica, why not rent a house in Ajaccio? Live amongst ordinary people.
Let me try to explain what I have in mind. When I came to Corsica, I determined to stay here in this seclusion for sufficient time to lay that damned ghost of Chavannes forever. I decided that a year and a day, that absurd legal period we occasionally use in English law, would be ample time for whatever it might be to move against me. I must not give up now, when the end is so close.
A year and a day. When does it expire?
Next Friday, at midnight.
Well, sir, you must do as you think fit. But promise me one thing.
What's that?
That next Saturday you'll join myself and a few other friends for the biggest celebratory dinner you've ever had.
Delighted, if I can choose the wine.
Oh.
Shall I put more coals on the fire, sir?
It's too hot in here as it is. The fire will do very well, Olivier. That clock, it's the correct time, isn't it?
It is, sir. I checked it against the one in the dining room not half an hour ago.
So, 10 minutes more, and we can burn that wretched hand on the fire. See it out of our lives for good.
Why not burn it now, sir?
What's that?
The wind appears to have dropped, sir. And I think the rain slackened.
All right, Olivier. You can go.
Oh, please let me stay.
I want you to go, now. If nothing happens within the next few minutes, then I would rather look a fool to myself alone. If Chavannes should come back, I don't want your death on my conscience.
I'd rather stay and chance it with you.
I appreciate your loyalty, but you have obeyed me implicitly until now. Don't spoil our relationship by trying to argue with me.
Very well, sir.
Pass me the revolver. Thank you.
I shall wait in the hall, sir. I have my own gun.
Very well, if you must. And if you hear anything at all to worry or disturb you, take the gray and ride straight to Monsieur Bermutier. He'll know what to do. Now, you understand me, don't you? On no account are you to attempt to enter this room alone unless you hear me specifically request you to do so. Now, go. I shall lock and bolt the door once you're outside.
Very good, sir. Good night, sir.
Good night, Olivier. All right, Olivier, try the door now.
It won't budge, sir.
Good. I shall go and sit by the fire. And Olivier?
Sir?
We shall drink a bottle of champagne together once midnight has struck, eh?
Yes, sir.
Revolver fully loaded. Safe to catch off. I shall be laughing at all this tomfoolery tomorrow morning. They're breathing. Chavannes? Chavannes, are you here? I hope so, because I've waited a long time for this rendezvous. Ah, the hand is it. The fingers begin to twitch. Is your owner close by? Come on, Chavannes! Show yourself like a man!
There was a terrible scream, and then I heard nothing more.
When was this?
Just before midnight, sir.
And you've tried the door, of course.
It's locked and bolted from the inside, sir.
You did the right thing in bringing me here, Olivier. If anything untoward has happened to Sir John, and I very much fear something has, then it's better there should be a reliable witness at your side. I'm sure that would have been your master's wish. Now, give me your revolver. Sir John! Sir John! Oh,
will let me go to him?
This is unbelievable.
He's dead.
And horribly.
I wanted to stay with him. I begged to stay.
Look at his throat, Olivier. As if he had been strangled by a skeleton.
The hand. It's gone.
The ring's been torn from the wall.
Then where is it? Where is the hand?
His mouth. Look at his mouth.
Oh, dear God.
A finger. He's bitten off. Someone's finger. It's wedged between his teeth.
But where is the hand, sir? Where is the hand? I like to think Sir John would have approved of his last resting place.
But there's something odd about it, Olivier.
In what way, monsieur?
Well, listen. Just listen.
I hear nothing. Except the surf in the distance.
Exactly. Everywhere else, birds and insects fill the air with sound. Here, nothing.
You're right, sir. It's uncanny.
Yet I don't remember this absolute silence when your master was first buried here.
Look, sir. There. On his grave.
Oh, my God. Oh,
my God. The hand that was never found.
And the forefinger. He's missing. Oh, this is a nightmare. And there's something else, Olivier. Look, gouged into the earth by the grave.
What, sir? What?
A word. The name. Chavannes.
That was The Hand by Guy de Maupassant, starring Denis Quilly as Sir John Rowe. Bermutier was played by Cyril Chaps, Olivier by Edward Seckerson, Audas by David Strong, and Chavannes by Hector Ross. Technical presentation was by Christopher Lewis. Murder International is devised and produced by Derek Hodinott.
A story about a severed hand that exacts revenge and then reunites with the body in the grave. Some intense stuff from Guy de Maupassant, as acted out by Murder International in The Hand. Next, we offer you Campbell Playhouse with The Count of Monte Cristo, starring Orson Welles and Agnes Moorehead. Right after this, you're listening to Old Time Radio Drama on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As Orson Welles so modestly puts it, this is our humble 57 minutes worth of The Count of Monte Cristo. Well, it is, after all, a monumental tome of a book, but trimmed down to perhaps the most exciting and memorable part of the plot, you come up with an action-packed 57 minutes it is. All beginning with a letter that gets young Edmond Dantès implicated in treason, and his story from, well, worse than rags to more than riches. In The Count of Monte Cristo, it's Campbell Playhouse from October 1st, 1939.
The makers of Campbell Soup presents The Campbell Playhouse. Orson Welles, producer.
I am the Count of Monte Cristo, and the world is mine.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Campbell Playhouse brings you those famous lines again. Revives tonight for you the world's favorite romance. This is Orson Welles, speaking to you only after a low bow to the memory of Henry Miller and James O'Neill and all the rest of his betters who've played the wonderful, mysterious gentleman from Corsica before him. Of the author of Alexander Dumas, who wrote Monte Cristo, there is no reasonable explanation. Dumas was a rich man. We note with interest that he went bankrupt in the theater. He was a revolutionary. His grandfather was a marquis. His grandmother was a negress. He was born as Napoleon became emperor. He died in poverty as the Germans marched into France. He wrote The Count of Monte Cristo as a newspaper serial. And shortly after the last installment, a ball and a bullfight were organized for him in Seville. And finally, in Algiers, the customs man let his baggage through without examination. Such things don't and can't happen today. But then neither does Alexander Dumas himself, the wildest romance of a man who could and did openly maintain at 70 numerous establishments and a literary factory as well, whose quantitative output is equaled in the arts only by the fabulous studio of Rubens. There's a good story about what Dumas Père told Dumas Fils. "Father," said the inventor of Camille, "I have just read your latest book." "Have you, my son?" said Dumas Père. "What's it about? I'm not sure I have." It's no secret and no shame either that the Chateau Monte Cristo was haunted by many ghostwriters and that its owner signed his name to more books than anyone could ever write. It is not expected of Pharaoh that he build with his own hands his own pyramids. And the mere blueprint of one Dumas plot is an airtight alibi for a whole career. Of all these plots, out of question, the most gloriously complex, as perfect as watchworks, and as big as Pittsburgh among all others, one Dumas plot persists as the most ingenious tall story ever perpetrated by the mind of man. God's vengeance on radio scriptwriters and your indestructible delight in spite of us. Here, then, is our humble 57 minutes worth of The Count of Monte Cristo. And just before we begin tonight's story, I want to confer the freedom of the microphone upon Ernest Chappell.
Thank you, Mr. Welles. Ladies and gentlemen, just the other day I sat down in the dining car of a train. I glanced around the tables near me to see what others were having for dinner. Perhaps you've done the same thing now and then because it sort of gives you an idea, doesn't it? Well, of 16 men and women whose plates I saw there in the diner, 10 were eating chicken. And I found my pencil writing on the order card. Chicken. Right then and there, I said to myself again, it must be this liking so many of us have for chicken that accounts for the great popularity of Campbell's chicken soup. Because this soup is chicken, through and through, from its golden surface to the very bottom of the plate. Its broth fairly glistens with chicken richness. Its fluffy rice is steeped in chicken flavor. And there are tender pieces of chicken meat in it to further tempt your spoon. That's why I promise you that just as sure as you like chicken, you like Campbell's chicken soup. If you haven't tried it, why don't you? Perhaps at dinner tomorrow night. And now, oh.
May I present the most talked-of man in Paris, the Count of Monte Cristo, the Baroness Montiego.
I am deeply honored.
Count of Monte Cristo.
What is it, Mercedes? Are you ill?
No. It's nothing, Fernand. Perhaps the heat of this room. Very kind of the Count to come here tonight. Will you give me your arm, Count Monte Cristo?
I am honored, madame.
Is it true, Count, what everyone is saying about you in Paris?
What are they saying, madame?
That you have seen so much, traveled so far, suffered so deeply.
I have suffered deeply, madame.
Now are you happy?
No doubt, since no one hears me complain.
Your present happiness, has it softened your heart?
My present happiness does not equal my past misery.
Are you not married?
I am married. No, madame.
You're alone, then?
I am alone.
You have no sister, no father?
I have nothing.
How can you exist, though, with no one to hold you to life?
Madame, a long time ago, I loved a girl. I was on the point of marrying her, madame, when we were separated. I thought she loved me well enough to wait for me and even to remain faithful to my grave. When I returned, she was married. Perhaps my heart was weaker than that of most, and I suffered more than they would have in my place. That is all, madame.
And you still preserve this love in your heart? It's true, we can love only once. Did you ever see her again?
Never.
You've forgiven her for all she made you suffer?
Yes. I have forgiven her.
Do you still hate those that separated you? Do you still want to punish them?
They will be punished, madame. But it is not I who will punish them. It is their own past. Society been more intrigued than it was the winter of 1834, when the mysterious Count de Monte Cristo appeared in the city of Paris. It is time now that the world should hear his story. Of the title of this man, nothing was known that winter save that he derived it from a small and uninhabited island off the coast of Corsica. The source of his fortune was equally obscure, and it seemed inexhaustible. The paintings in his house in the Champs-Élysées were valued at 7 million francs. His collection of precious stones far exceeded in value that of any of the crowned heads of Europe. Yet it was not his wealth alone that made him remarkable. At a dinner party that winter, a woman was heard to say that the Count of Monte Cristo had the look of a man who had been enclosed for a long time in a tomb. I heard her say it. The long years in solitary confinement sharpen the hearing. The look of a man, she said, who has been enclosed for a long time in a tomb. No man but I could know how truly the lady had spoken. If to live in darkness for 20 years, in darkness and silence, underground and alone, if this is to dwell in a tomb, then the Count of Monte Cristo had dwelt in a tomb. I alone can speak of these things, for I alone know the true name of the Count of Monte Cristo. It is mine. It is Edmond Dantès. The story of Edmond Dantès begins in 1814, the year the Emperor Napoleon was a prisoner in Elba. It begins with a wedding.
To the name of Edmond Dantès.
Edmond Dantès, he's my son. What do you want of him?
Edmond Dantès, in the name of the law, I arrest you.
Arrest me? What have I done?
I cannot inform you. You'll be duly acquainted with the reason for your arrest at your first examination.
Julian, what has he done? Officer, he's done nothing wrong. He's my son. He's a good boy.
Edmond Dantès, you're under arrest. Follow me.
Edmond!
Your name?
Are you the king's prosecutor, sir?
Yes, yes.
My name is Edmond Dantès.
You will kindly give me all the information in your power. You have served under the usurper Napoleon?
No, sir.
Edmund Dantès, it is reported that your political opinions are extreme.
My political opinions? Alas, I never had any opinions. I'm hardly 20, sir. I was to be married today.
What do you make of this? It is a letter, Monsieur Dantès. Well, read it.
The king's prosecutor is hereby informed by friends of the throne and religion that one Edmund Dantès, mate of the ship Ferrol, arrived this morning from Smyrna, having touched at Naples and the Isle of Elba. He has been entrusted by the usurper Napoleon with a letter to the Bonapartist Committee in Paris. This letter will be found on his person, or at his father's, or in his cabin aboard the Ferrol. Oh, sorry, sir, I don't understand it.
You know the writing?
No, sir.
Well, whoever wrote it writes well. Have you any enemies?
Not that I know of, sir.
Now, answer me frankly. Not as a prisoner to a judge, but as one man to another. Is there any truth in this accusation?
No, sir. I swear by my honor as a sailor,
sir. Go on.
The day after we left Naples, when my captain lay dying, he gave me a package to be delivered on the island of Elba.
What did you do with it?
What should I have done? What every man would have done in my place. I sailed for the island of Elba. I delivered the packet and was given in return a letter to be delivered to a man here in Marseille. I did exactly what my captain told me to do, sir. I landed here yesterday. That's all, sir.
I see. Well, it sounds like the truth. Now, you give up this letter you brought from Elba and give me your word that you will appear if you're called and you may go back to your friends.
I'm free then, sir.
Yes, but first, give me the letter.
Here you are, sir.
Very well. By the way, to whom were you to deliver this letter?
To Francois Noitier, this
citizen. Francois Noitier?
Yes, sir. Why? You know this man?
A faithful servant of the king does not know conspirators. Have you shown this letter to anyone?
To no one, sir. On my honor.
No. No one knows that you are the bearer of a letter from the Isle of Elba, addressed to Francois Noitier?
Nobody, sir, except the one person who gave it to me. Why, sir? What's the matter, sir?
You give me your word of honor that you are ignorant of the contents of this letter?
My word of honor, sir, but what's the matter? You're ill, sir. Can I help
you? No, stay where you are, Edmund Dantès. For me to give orders, not you. I am sorry. I am no longer able, as I had hoped, to restore you to liberty. Before doing so, there are formalities to be gone through.
But, sir,
I will try to make them as short as possible. Now, the principal charge against you, as you know, is this letter. You see what I do with it. You see, I destroy it. Now I can find it to the flames.
You forgive for your goodness itself.
Now then, do you trust me?
Order me, sir, and I will obey.
Hey, listen. This is not an order, but advice that I give you.
Yes, monsieur.
I shall keep you until this evening, here, in the Palais de Justice.
Yes, sir.
Should anyone else question you, do not breathe a word of this letter.
I promise.
You see, the letter is destroyed. You and I alone know of its existence. So if they question you about it, deny all knowledge of it.
I will, sir.
It was the only letter you had?
Yes, sir.
I swear it.
I swear it.
Good. Now then, not a word to anyone, remember.
Yes, sir.
Your Honor.
You will take this man to the guard room and hold him there. He is to see nobody, you understand? Nobody.
Yes, sir.
Follow this officer, Monsieur Dantès. Later, I will give him his orders.
Come to fetch me?
Yes.
By the order of the king's prosecutor?
I believe so. Come with us.
Where are you taking me?
You don't
know. For the love of heaven, where are we going?
You, a native of Marseille and a sailor, and you don't know where you're going?
I have no idea.
Unless you're blind or have never been outside the harbor, you must...
No!
Look around you.
The prison. The Chateau d'If.
Quite right, my friend. The Chateau d'If.
Help, help. Let me go. I'm innocent. I'm innocent. I do not know.
Are you hungry?
I do not know.
What did he say?
I want to see the governor. The governor, do you hear me? I'm innocent. I'm innocent. I'm innocent.
Well, are you reasonable today?
I want to see the governor.
I've told you that's impossible.
Why is it impossible?
Not allowed.
Why is it not allowed? I'm innocent.
Take my advice, my friend. Don't brood over what is impossible. You'll go out of your head.
Listen to me. I want to see the governor.
If you don't let me see the governor someday, I'll hide behind the door, and when you come in, I'll dash out your brains with this stool.
Put on the stool.
Are you going to let me see the governor?
Put on the stool. Put it down.
Well, do I see the governor?
Yes, you'll see the governor at once. At once. Sooner than you think. Corporal of the guard. Halt. By the governor's orders. Take this prisoner to the floor below.
The dungeon?
That's where we put our madmen. The dungeon.
What? Attention.
I tell you, I'm in.
Quiet.
I'm innocent. I'm innocent.
Fire.
Darkness and silence, underground and alone. Every day, twice a day, morning and evening, the jailer came to my cell and put down the vile food and went away without speaking to me. My hair and nails had grown long, and my skin was white as a leper's. I'd been proud the first month. Now I began to beg. I begged to be moved from this dungeon to another. I begged to be allowed to walk around. I begged for books. Nothing was granted. I spoke to the jailer when he brought me my food. He rarely answered me. I tried to speak when alone, but the sound of my own voice terrified me. After what must have been 3 or 4 years, the governor of the Chateau d'If was transferred. The new man did not trouble to learn my name. I was no longer Edmond Dantès. I was number 37. I took to praying, but not as men pray in prosperity. In my prayers, I laid every action of my life before the Almighty. Still, I remained a prisoner. Then a deep gloom took possession of me, and then furious rage and savage thoughts of revenge, and wildly I dashed myself against the walls of my prison. I tore at my own flesh with my nails, and then I began to think of dying. I swore I would starve myself to death. So every morning and every evening, I threw out through the small grated window all the food the jailer brought me. At first gaily, then thoughtfully, then with regret. I held the plate in my hand for an hour at a time, gazing at the morsel of bad meat, of tainted fish, of black and moldy bread. One day I found I had not sufficient force to throw my supper out of the window. The next morning I could hardly see or hear. I knew I was dying. The day went by. I felt a stupor creeping over me. The gnawing pain at my stomach had ceased and my thirst had abated. When I closed my eyes, I saw myriads of lights dancing before them. I was on the edge of that mysterious country called death. Suddenly, a little after dark, I heard a hollow sound in the wall against which I was lying. I sat up and listened. It was a continuous scratching, as if made by a huge claw, some iron instrument scraping against the stones. Then all was silent. Soon it began again. Nearer and more distinct. Perhaps it was only a workman repairing a neighboring dungeon. I'd soon find out. The sound continued. With my earthenware jug, I knocked against the wall where the sound came. Someone had heard me. Each time I knocked, the knocks were repeated on the other side of the wall. Stopped knocking, the other also stopped. After that, there were no more sounds. The night passed in complete silence. I never closed my eyes. 3 days passed. 3 long days. And never a sound. At last, on the fourth evening, whoever it was quite close to me now. I wanted desperately to help him, but I had nothing, no knife or sharp instrument. I smashed my earthenware jug. That night, I moved my bed from the wall and started to scrape the plaster with a piece of the broken jug. Soon, the fragments of plaster began to fall away. In 3 days, I uncovered a large stone. The next day, about noon, the stone began to move.
Oh, my God. My God. My God, don't fail me now.
Who talks of God in this place?
Speak again. In the name of heaven. Speak.
Who are you?
A prisoner.
Of what country?
A Frenchman.
Your name?
Edmond Dantès.
How long have you been here?
Since the 28th day of February, 1815.
You're crying.
I'm innocent. And you? Who are you?
I am number 27.
How long have you been here?
Since 1804. 20 years.
All that night we worked. Then, just before dawn, a portion of the floor in my cell gave way, and from the bottom of this passage, the depth of which was impossible to measure, appeared the head, then the shoulders, and lastly, the body of a man. To this man, I owe all that I possess, all that I know, all that I've become. In the prison, he was known as the Mad Priest. I never learned his name. For 8 years, we saw each other every day, using the tunnel he had dug through the solid rock, concealing the mouth of the passage with stones carefully fitted in place. By the sundial he had traced on the wall of his cell, we knew the hours of the guard's visit. The rest of the day, we were together. He'd been a great scholar in his day, and all that he knew he taught me with infinite, loving patience. Day after day, year after year. Then one morning, when I came down, I found him standing in the middle of the cell, pale as death.
Quick, Dantès, quick. Listen to what I have to say.
What is it, Father? Tell me, I beseech you.
I'm dying. Help me to my death.
Yes, Father.
You see, half of my body is paralyzed already. Careful.
Yes.
Oh, thank you, my son. Now listen to me.
Yes, Father.
All is over with me. This night or tomorrow, I will be dead.
Oh, but Father, you can't.
I know the illness. There is no hope. And I shall never leave this place now. Before I die, there's something I want to give you. Here, look. It's just a burned piece of parchment. But, my child, it is my treasure. From this day forth, it belongs to you.
Your treasure?
Oh, yes. I know what is passing through your mind at this moment. Even now, you, like all the others. But be assured, my child, I'm not mad. This treasure exists. Have you ever heard of the great Sparta treasure?
The Sparta treasure? I've heard sailors talk of it.
For 10 years, I worked for the House of Sparta. That paper that you have in your hand is what is left of the will of Cardinal Sparta, murdered by Rodrigo Borgia. Now, take the paper and put the two pieces together and read.
On the 25th day of April, 1498, being invited to dine by His Holiness Alexander VI and fearing for my life, I declare to my nephew, Guido Spada, my sole heir, that I have buried in a place he knows, in a cave of the island of Monte Cristo, all that I possess of ingots, gold, monies, jewels, and diamonds, which treasure may amount to nearly 10 millions of Roman crowns, which you will find in the farthest angle of the island cave, and this treasure I bequeath and leave entirely to him as my sole heir, says Spada. 10 million crowns.
Yes. 100 million francs of our money. Think of the good a man could do in the world with 100 million francs.
Yes.
The treasure is yours, my son. I bequeath it to you. Whenever you are freed, you have only to go to the island of Monte Cristo, and it will be there for you.
But I have no right to it, sir.
You are my son, Dante. You are the child that God sent to console me in my captivity.
In fearful agony, he died. I closed his eyes and laid him out to rest as well as I could, and that night the governor of the prison came down to look at the boy. I watched him from my hiding place in the cell.
Is he dead?
He's dead, all right, Your Honor.
He was a priest. Get him the new estate if we find.
What time shall we bury him, sir?
The usual time, before dawn. And report to me when it's done.
Very good, sir.
When the cell was empty again, I went in. On the bed at full length and faintly lighted by the light of a single candle was visible a sack of coarse cloth, and in it was stretched a long and stiffened form. Quickly, I unlaced the sack, drew out the corpse of the priest, and carried it through the tunnel to my cell. I laid it on my bed, turned the head to the wall, and covered it with a sheet. For the last time, I kissed the ice-cold brow. Then I went back to the dead man's cell. Could hear steps in the passage and voices as the guards came back with a stretcher. Quickly, I got into the sack. In place of the corpse, I laced the sack around my body. I lay stiff, hoping that they would not hear the beating of my heart.
Here we go. You take the head, I'll take the beat. It's heavy enough for an old man. Well, they say every year adds half a pound of the bones.
All right. Up, Chico.
I got it. Here we go.
Funny thing. You're feeling through the sack. It's dead 12 hours and it's still warm.
Yeah, only when I open this door. Oh, Lord, it's cold up here. This'll cool him off. Have you got the weight?
There it is.
Tie it on. Round his feet. Yeah, that's right.
Tight. If you can do it any tighter.
Yeah, that's all right. That'll sink him. All right, now. You ready? One. Two.
Wait. Wait a minute. Get nearer the edge. The last one was mashed on a rock, and we got the blame for it.
All right. Come on. Easy. Let's go. One, two, three.
Listening to the Campbell Playhouse presentation of The Count of Monte Cristo, starring Orson Welles. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. This is Ernest Chappell, ladies and gentlemen, welcoming you back to the Campbell Playhouse. In a moment, we shall resume our presentation of The Count of Monte Cristo. Lately, I've been speaking of the increasing numbers of good home cooks who, after years of making their own soup, have put by their kettles and are now letting Campbell's make soup for them. Tonight, I'd like you to hear from a woman who is herself one of these good home cooks. She's Mrs. Barbara Roth of 2134 24th Street, Astoria, Long Island, who has come to our studio to tell you personally what she told us in a recent letter. Will you read it now, Mrs. Roth?
Ever since I can remember, we've had soup with our main meal every day. Mother and I would cook soup each Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday, a 2-day supply each time. It was a big job and a long cooking procedure, but Mother has always insisted we need soup every day. About 6 months ago, we tried our first can of Campbell's soup. Well, the decision was unanimous in favor of Campbell's. Since that time, we've enjoyed not only the good taste of Campbell's soups, but also the easy way of preparing them. So I just don't wonder at all that people are giving up soup making at home. We've tried nearly every soup that Campbell's make and found each one such a treat, we thought you were entitled to know about it.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Roth. Indeed, we do appreciate knowing about it. Certainly, we at Campbell's are devoting time and care and all our skill to the making of soups worthy of a place at your table. And that's why I want to say to every other good home cook listening tonight, we'd like to make soup for you, too. If you haven't done so already, will you give us a trial? Try Campbell's chicken soup, for instance, for its deep, rich chicken flavor. Or try Campbell's vegetable soup, a soup that's practically a meal in itself. If you'll do this and let the fine flavor of these Campbell soups speak for itself to you and your family, I'm almost certain you'll say, well, soup is one thing I no longer need make in my home.